Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled A Conversation with Walter Wriston and Herbert Pardes. Recorded in 2004, Walter B. Wriston, former chairman and CEO of Citicorp Citibank, and Herbert Pardes, MD, president, and CEO, New York Presbyterian Hospital, discuss healthcare costs, HMOs, and the impact of technology on medicine. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, Walter, I enjoy the opportunity to get a little sense of your kind of long view on our hospital, the New York Presbyterian Hospital, and also healthcare in general. When did you first get involved in the hospitals here?
One of the interesting things was that I started out in a hospital for special surgery, and it was run by a fellow called Herb Bastido, and the elder Phil Wilson was the surgeon in chief. And it was this reincarnation of the hospital for crippled and people that was basically for polio. And the shock vaccine put them out of business and they moved uptown. And after I was there for 2 or 3 years, I got a call to go as a public member of the Joint Administrative Board, New York Hospital and Cornell Medical School. And so the president of special surgery took me up to a high place and said, look, he said, all these people are after in New York is our endowment. And I said, well, I'm not sure about that, but Arthur Dean was the only public member, and there were three from the hospital and three from the school. Right. And the public member was supposed to break the tie. And as you know, the relationships between the medical schools and the hospitals are not always salubrious.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
You've noticed that. And depending on the dean, we're very fortunate, in my opinion, now with Tony Gatto.
Right.
He's the best I've ever seen.
But
at any rate, I took the job, and in order to defuse the special surgery, I invited them to come to the meetings. And it was boring beyond belief. And so after a while, they went away. And I went from there on to New York Hospital.
So that means that you really started with New York Hospital. What was the rough year about the?
I don't know, in the 50s sometime.
Mm-hmm. Boy, so you've known it for a good while.
And we had this person in New York State, Axelrod, who was a commissioner of health.
Right.
And he could write more rules than the IRS. And he used to come to the hospital, and we'd all sit there, and he said, you should merge with special surgery. And I would explain to him that special surgery could raise money like you can't believe. And we could raise money, and if we merged, we wouldn't have as much money. And this turned out to be true, but he never gave up. And he made all of those rules. That's why you can't have all private rooms.
Right.
Because he said you had to have dual rooms, which is more expensive at the end of the day. But anyway, so I was there in the old days when the hospital was small and was run out of the corner of the Griffiths Faculty Club.
Mm-hmm.
And then the revolution started when we were asked to recruit a new person to take Dave Thompson's place.
So you were there for a good portion of David Thompson's tenure.
Yeah, a long time. Mm-hmm. And the board was basically boilerplate. And they were recruited for if they could give money or do whatever, but almost nothing involvement in the thing.
Right.
And then when Dave was going, we recruited Dave Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
And tell you a funny story about that. I was on the search committee, and Skinner was recommended by Tom Shires, who was the head of surgery. And so I called up Hannah, who was the president of University of Chicago, who I just happened to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Hannah, what do you think of Dave Skinner? There was this long pause, and she said, why? And I said, well, we're thinking of having run New York Hospital. And there's another long pause, and I said, well, what about it? And she said, well, he lost an argument in the faculty. And he went home and he wrote a letter to every member of the community explaining why we were wrong and he was right. And I said, he's my kind of a guy. So he came on, and for the first time, he was a revolutionary force.
Yes.
And he insisted on operating every Monday, which right. I thought was remarkable. Yeah. And he was an expert on esophagus. He replaced them with parts of the small intestine. And he said to the board, you guys better work or you're out of here, in a very nice way. Mm-hmm. His predecessor thought that women were decorative but unuseful. Mm-hmm. Dave said to Charlotte Ford, I want you to go give quality control. And she went and worked. And he said to Marife Hernandez, I want you out there to figure out the amenities in the place because they're terrible. And he put everybody to work. And I think the result was that the hospital benefited because he got a lot of people involved.
Right.
And I have to say I was surprised that uptown, the people who were there were not as involved as the guys downtown, mm-hmm. I thought.
Yeah, I think that probably the family of people who constituted the New York Hospital Board were pretty tight. They knew each other well. There was a sense of a common purpose, and then Dave really fostered that.
Yeah, he was an extraordinary man.
Yeah,
and so that's how I got involved in it. And I think the most astonishing thing was the speech that you made on what had happened to medicine, and when you used Eisenhower's heart attack lying in bed for right. 6 weeks.
That's right.
And now you've got Cheney with a defibrillator going back to work in 2 days.
I think the revolution in heart disease has been spectacular. And I think that what we've done for people and what we see happening is tremendously uplifting. I mean, the length of life, the quality of life changing dramatically. And one of the nice things is that a hospital like New York Hospital, in conjunction with Cornell and now New York Presbyterian, are where these things happen. Had you had involvement with health care, other than your own personal health care, before joining the Special Surgery Board?
No, but later on I ran the health care task force of the Business Roundtable. And at a time when it was clear that health care costs were going to accelerate.
Right.
And nobody knows what percentage of GNP health care should be.
Right.
But it's high. But not as high as in other places. So the prevailing view at that time was the savior was going to be HMOs. And it turned out that wasn't necessarily true.
Right.
But that's what we thought at the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of HMOs were set up and patients hated them. And we were in a constant conversation with HIP. And HIP was not really an HMO. They had a wider thing, but they were big. And they were run by a guy called Jack Beagle, who was the choreographer of the municipal labor unions,
mm-hmm.
and a very good guy, actually, when you got to know him.
Right.
It took a while.
Well, you know, I can remember when, at one point, I think we counted something in the neighborhood of 1,000 or more pending legislation around the country in various states about HMOs, managed care companies, because of the widespread public reaction to them. And I think really what's happened, wouldn't you say, is that the American people said, we're not going to accept some of their dictates.
That's exactly right. And they were embraced by corporations because it looked as if it would save money.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it either saved money or made the patients happy. And the doctors didn't like them either.
Oh, yep.
So that You see, when Nixon put in price and wage controls, I happened to be down there on the deal, and George Meany, who's a very smart guy, the AFL-CIO, couldn't get raises for his people. So he invented free health care. And so it was an artifact of wage control. So mm-hmm. they said, well, if you give the guys health care, it doesn't raise their wages.
Right.
Which was sort of a nonsensical argument.
Absolutely.
But that's how it started. So today, the liability of General Motors and these big companies is astronomical.
Right.
And I don't have any idea how it's going to get solved.
I think you put your finger on a very tender point, that the health benefits are substantial. So you've got the, you know, all the pluses and minuses. You've got all this wonderful thing, these wonderful things that healthcare can do. But you're right. What the right cost should be, I don't know. And one could argue that when one thinks in terms of a field that can give you longer life, better life, cure diseases, get you back to work, get you back to your family, it's spectacular. But that certainly plagues us today. And the cost of health benefits for everybody, even healthcare institutions, it's a major challenge.
And we have the drugs today are very cheap from an economic point of view. They keep people out of the hospital.
Right.
They get them back to work quicker. They get productive. They help the economy. But for the individual who gets a $500 pill or whatever it is, it's not cheap.
Right.
And so the disconnect between the reality of the economy and the individual is immense.
You know, Walter, it strikes me that having gotten involved in the 50s, and now here we are sitting in 2004, and just as you said, the example of how long Eisenhower was out of commission for a heart episode and how long Cheney was, that you really have seen in these last five decades the extraordinary improvement in what medicine can do. I'd imagine you probably could think back to, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago and now, and it must seem starkly different to you.
Yeah, well, we just think of the shock vaccine.
Right.
My daughter was a polio pioneer, and half her class got a placebo, and half got the vaccine. And the only people in her class who were told not to take it were kids of doctors. And but that's an incredible event. When I was a boy, the richest guy in town was a mastoid surgeon.
Uh-huh.
And you go to a medical school today, they never heard of mastoid.
That's right. I mean, there are all kinds of things that doctors today have not seen, which were all over the place in those days. And you know, you mentioned the iron lung machine. When Senators Harkin and Specter, I think it was, or Specter and Hatfield, put together a set of testimonies at the Congress. They were showing the value of healthcare and healthcare research. They put an iron lung machine right at the front of the witness table and said, here's something that's no longer there. And one of the nice things is to look at, there have been some substantial innovations like the contraction of the number of days for hospitalization that have had enormous financial savings. But you also probably have watched medicine become more technological. And I wonder what your take is on that, how you, when you saw that really take off and how you see it evolving.
Well, I see the doctors today are running and 15-minute segments. And it's the old-time doctor who would sit down and talk to you for half an hour is an endangered species.
Right.
There's a few of them around, Reese Pritchard, people like that, but they're the old school. But today, the information that they have with a CAT scan, with an MRI, with ultrasound, and even old X-rays, this order of magnitude so great that it's, and now they have the new GE that looks you, lets you look inside a beating heart and rotate it 360 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally amazing. And you have arthroscopic surgery, and in our hospital now you're working on the robotics for open heart surgery.
Yep.
With a very small incision, but a very long operation.
Right.
So you got a trade-off on anesthesia and all that sort of thing. But it's, I don't know how you resolve this dilemma, because I see doctors up there like Joe Hayes who are teaching and who are in a hospital committee working on something and are handling patients. They got five examining rooms. They mm-hmm. go from one to one to the other. And people are teed off about the amount of time a doctor can spend.
Right.
And the doctors are unhappy because they are all amazing people. They want to help.
Sure.
And they're spent, I don't know, 7 years of their life learning their trade, and they're not allowed to practice it.
Right.
And I have no idea. That's your problem. You're the CEO.
Well, I think that is really one of the major problems of the day. Between the big focus on reimbursement and time, the fact that it's very difficult to get the managed care firms, the other third-party carriers, to pay for that interpersonal time, I think it's cut in heavily to the feeling about the doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, often a doctor will get her best information or his best information as you go into the conversation. Person comes in, they feel a little anxious, they don't quite tell you exactly what's on their mind. And I used to joke with the students that at the end of the interview, the patient would walk out and say at the last moment, "So I guess that blood in my urine isn't that important after all." And it was the first time the doctor heard about it. But it was only when the patient became comfortable speaking
sure.
that they could do that. If you have a 6 minute conversation, do they ever get to that point? And you're right, you've got the spectacular models like a Reese Pritchett or a Chuck Steinfeld, Chuck Steinberg or Harvey Klein or others, Joe
sure.
Hayes, who are trying to maintain that interpersonal. I guess the thing is to try to figure out a way to make the technology, which I think is one of, it can be an asset, help us so maybe it takes a little of the other burden away from us and enables us to spend more time with patients. So, I mean, one of the things that I know you know quite a bit about and have been interested in is the whole issue of how the information systems that are starting to come into healthcare may help us. I guess what is your feeling about what that might promise for better healthcare or medicine?
Well, it's obviously going to promise a lot, but I was thinking the other night walking home, I remember when computers first came in, there were learned articles written, what are we going to do with our leisure time? We're all going to be working a 3-day week. Remember that?
Yes.
Because all the computers are going to take over. And the answer is we're all working a 7-day week, and it never happened.
Right.
But on the information, on one is patient records. And the ability of the screen on the emergency room to pull up a patient record is going to be spectacular when it gets all in there.
Right.
Which we haven't got yet, but we're headed toward that thing. Second is the 20% or whatever it is, mistakes made by the pharmacy because they couldn't read anybody's writing is going to be put down to close to zero with order entry at the bedside. And that will be very spectacular.
Absolutely.
And the third thing is all of the radiology now is voice over, where the doctor looks at the thing and talks about what it is and it's automatically transcribed. Mm-hmm. That's been very high productivity. But what hasn't been any productivity is that when you have, quote, free health care, which means somebody else pays for it,
right,
basically, the demand is unlimited. And so guys with a toenail that hurts or got a headache and take an aspirin, they're likely to go to see a doctor. And I don't know how you change that, except unless you have bigger co-pays. And that politically is something you can sell, maybe,
right,
but very difficult.
Well, I do think that a person having some responsibility for their healthcare expenses makes them think twice about being too casual about using it.
Sure.
So whatever system, if we can get to that, I think should include a person feeling some, as I say, feeling some pain or so, so that they don't take it casually, you don't just go at the drop of a hat. I happen to feel, as you do, that information systems will reduce errors. I think the phenomenon of having instant information in an interconnected system is spectacular. The fact that you or I could be anywhere in the country, and if we had such a system, that they can get up our information right away, gives us a much better chance at a quality outcome. You have somebody comes into the hospital who's unconscious, and you know little about them except you get a quick identity. I remember the days when we used to call for the old records. That would take a few days to get them from the record room, and then have to pour through them. Now you got to get instant information. Now, it seems to me the challenge for us is to blend the technological advancements with the need to retain this very strong interpersonal character of medicine. And I don't know if anybody's got a good answer as to how to do that. I'll tell you one other thought. I'm curious about your reaction to this. Many of us in the field are starting to talk about the patient as being his own primary care doctor. In other words, become informed. You'll take better care of yourself. There's some things you won't have to go for, and when you go there, you'll start off, you know, much further along in the conversation, because you know what's your feeling about.
I think you have to manage your own health, and doctors are busy, and if you don't manage your own health, that is, you know, you eat properly, you exercise, you do all of those things. And if you have symptoms, which most people know when they're sick, I didn't happen to know, but most people know when they're sick, and they can say to a doctor. So that the problem is that we've grown up a society, instead of self-reliance, we've all become victims. You know, if I cross the street against the light and get hit by a car, it's the car's fault, it's not mine. The crazy guy, he went through a green light on that thing. That's one problem, and one of the reasons that we've done that is the plaintiff's bar. And I know some doctors around, they won't deliver babies anymore because the trying to get insurance is ridiculous.
Very, very major problem. Major problem for us.
And the House of Representatives will pass a bill to put there are seven states, I believe, now that have a 250 cap on pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. But the House will pass it every year. But the Senate is, 80% of them are lawyers. And they're all living in the pocket of the plaintiff's bar, which finances them. But I don't see any way out of that problem.
You know, I agree with you fully about how serious that is. Particularly obstetricians, for example, you make a good point about the number of people who are not going to be delivering babies. In one of the most recent matches of people who want to go into obstetrics and positions, it was found that the addition of U.S. medical graduates, plus the foreign medical graduates who were interested, did not give enough of a number to fill the residency positions around the United States.
And the matching.
Right, which is not a very typical phenomenon. Usually you're oversubscribed.
Sure.
Well, that means less people being trained. A very substantial portion of the obstetricians in this country are over 60. They will gradually, you know, retire. A lot of young people, just as you say, are saying, I'm going to do gynecology and not do obstetrics. So we pointed out to some, well, I pointed out to Frist and Clinton recently, that we've got a serious access to care problem in addition to it being a serious financial problem. And I think the only way we're going to get some relief on this is if they really reach across the aisles to each other and say, listen, we have difference of opinion, but we got to work together. We got to, this is getting deadly serious.
Yeah. Well, in addition to them not being able to get the thing, the plaintiff's bar has created an atmosphere that you're all victims. You know, whatever it is, the disease of the week, you see the ads in the paper. You know, did your mother snarl at you when you were 6 years old? we're going to sue the psychiatrist because, or whatever. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
But that contributes to the victimization belief. And the old American thing is, you know, I take care of myself, I'll help you too, but I'm responsible for me.
Right.
And it started, I think, with a smoking deal. I mean, on the cigarettes it says, this will kill you, in big black letters. And then guys get multi-million dollar settlements. How did I know?
You know? Right.
I was a victim.
No, I share your concern. I think that the we're in a very unfortunate situation in this country because of the potency of the legal system over the political system. And there, you're right, there are a number of states who've finally done something. But I would wonder, you know, many have said that one of the answers here might be a more extensive tort reform in which you'd have medical courts with expert witnesses and judges who are knowledgeable. You might have a schedule of certain kind of payments for certain kind of situations.
Sure.
And you try to deal with more expeditiously. The patient, the complainant gets their case settled more rapidly. The physician does as well. The people who make a little less money might be the trial lawyers, but certainly I would imagine maybe you agree that getting to something like that is going to be critical.
Yeah, in a sense, it's a cop-out in that it still has the same legal problems, but it throws out junk science, and it's hopefully gets knowledgeable judges, or maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the basic problem remains that if there isn't a cap on pain and suffering, these guys are going to work that system.
Yep.
I don't know how they do it, but they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think tort reform is so much a part of the medical system now. And how you mobilize that, I don't know. But.
Right. Well, I can tell you, we've had our difficulties trying to get leadership across the aisle between the two
terrible
parties. It's a threat to access to care, an increasing financial hit on health care. You know, I wonder if you feel as I do that when you think of health care, you think of these two opposing trends. One is the spectacular advances, as you said, which gets Cheney in and out of the hospital in a couple of days when Eisenhower was compromised for 7 weeks, and all kinds of other dazzling developments, and then a system which is really ravaged at the moment. It is really somewhat chaotic.
Yeah.
And you know, United States, I think United States, when it thinks of the areas where it leads, top quality medicine, top quality medical research, is one of those areas. I guess you having seen New York Hospital, New York Presbyterian Hospital now over the years, how have you seen its role in the evolution of medicine, medicine getting better and better, or being able to do more and more over the years?
The Presbyterian campus in New York, there, you got the Whipple operation out in Pennsylvania, you got the Pap test down in New York, you have fantastic intellectual horsepower that is unselfish in the sense that it's working for the common good. And then you have this overlay of the legal system. Now, the fellow who wrote this book called The Death of Common Sense is putting together a coalition now, and I notice your name is on it, for trying to bring common sense to the legal profession. Now, I'm all in favor of that, but as you say, we've got to get cooperation across the aisle, but the first step, I think, is to cap the pain and suffering.
Right.
And judge shopping and venue shopping and all that, I understand, but the basic thing, if we did that, then the rates on D&O insurance would have to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what a New York Presbyterian Hospital surgeon's D&O is these days, but it must be horrendous.
Right. Well, I'm not sure the exact number myself, but you're right.
But it must be well over $100,000.
Yep.
And so the same guys in the Congress who are yelling about the cost of health care are sitting there driving it up. But that's only a guy with school diplomacy would say that, but that's true.
You having seen New York Hospital over the years, Walt, then watched and were a participant. You were one of the trustees at the time that New York and Presbyterian decided to bring it together. I think it was a very courageous step, very visionary step on the part of the trustees. What do you think was in people's mind at the time that was up for discussion?
Well, I think it was a question of leadership. And Skinner had no right really to be as good an administrator as he was. I mean, all he did was a small surgical company. Right. And he was a spectacular administrator.
Absolutely.
And he said, look, he said, we got too many beds in New York, and we've closed, 30,000 of them, very close to that. And he said, the hospitals are not going to survive. They're going to go broke, and we have to put together a critical mass that will become a world-class center. And, you know, a lot of life is luck, and it happened that at the Presbyterian campus you had a deal maker, John Mack.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened in the New York campus you had a guy who engineered three tough mergers, John McGillicuddy. So usually that circumstance never happens. And so two deal makers got together and they made a deal. And they looked at the failure of New York University and Mount Sinai. And their failure was they tried to merge the medical schools.
Right.
And so they said, we're not going to touch the medical schools. They're going to be their own. We'll just merge the hospitals. And they made a deal. And you can argue about whether the details. And you can argue about what happened uptown with the spec and all of that. And you can do all kinds of carnage that took place. But at the end of the day, it was the right thing to do.
Amen.
And one of the most interesting things to me was, you know, our friend Hank Greenberg tried to organize a cabal to kill the merger.
Right.
And I told him I wouldn't play. And so McGillicuddy and Mack and I guess you were there, I'm not sure. Had a meeting, and they had all the trustees, and it was like 7 o'clock at night, and they said, anything you guys want to say, say. And that was amazing. And two or three people got up and said, this was a terrible idea, you shouldn't be merging it, and this is a takeover, depending on which side you were on. New York's taking it over, Presbyterian's right. taking it over. Those guys uptown don't know anything. Those clowns downtown are terrible medicine, so on and so forth. But they let it all hang out in a way that I've never seen in my life. Yeah. And some of us spoke and said, you know, this is a good idea. And it went together, and then you came in and you made it work. And you got the channels going. And like all mergers, it started with two clinical heads, which everybody knows won't work, right. but makes everybody happy for a few minutes. And then it sorts itself out.
Well, you know, I think that the both hospitals and everybody who has anything to do with hospitals were lucky to have the vision that John McGillicuddy and John Mack and Frank Benick and Dan
guy.
Burke and you and so many others. It is really a spectacular group of people who, you know, and maybe it says something about having people on the boards who think big, who are not threatened by what was a very courageous and radical move.
Was terrible. Yeah.
To think of New York Hospital, I mean, it's probably somebody 20, 30 years ago saying the phenomenon of New York Hospital and Columbia Presbyterian joining would have been unthinkable. But I have to say that the credit should go to the trustees and David Skinner and Bill Speck and that group of people who saw a great opportunity and position the institution marvelously for the future in what is really a tough environment. Just as we've been talking about before, these are tough times for hospitals, and I think what you did was you put the New York Presbyterian in a strong position to be able to sustain a tough era.
It was remarkable when you think of all the ones that have failed. And I get the sense with you know, I haven't been as active anymore because my problem, but I get the sense that the mixture, the parties, the galas or whatever, that the doctors on both campuses say, hey, you know, the guy on the other campus isn't really that stupid.
You got it.
And he said, we've been competitors for years. But, you know, maybe he knows something.
I think you're absolutely right. People are starting to feel that they got buddies right next to them in the same campus and also across the way. And, you know, Daracott Vaughan working with Peter Schlegel and some of the urology people, Jack Barkas working with Fred Cass, it's spreading. But I think that the hospitals were well served, just as you said, by having people who could think big, whose value was really in creating a strong place with excellence. And therefore, they saw a dream that they wanted to realize. And I think that one of the things that's made it work is people who've kept their eye on the ball of, let's create something excellent for all New Yorkers. It's nice that the New York Presbyterian now takes care of one of every four people who come for healthcare in New York. Those are big. That's a big volume, big activity.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, Walt, I hope you realize how much we appreciate that you've been such a friend of the institution and been so important in making it first class.
I didn't know much, but it's been a great trip, and the people there are extraordinary.
Well, I can tell you, Walter Wriston probably is most essentially known by the fact that if you listen to him, he didn't do much anything about anything, but you know, some right around him, there were also always great things happen.
Yeah, well, I've had a lot of great people around it. But I don't know, on the two campuses, You're going to have a chief in each one?
It'll vary. It'll vary according to the need. Sometimes there'll be one chief for both. Sometimes there'll be two chiefs. Sometimes, I think what we've seen works is to customize the arrangement to the particular medical area, and it's been coming up roses. So, you know, rehabilitation medicine, one service. We don't need two burn centers. We don't need two gamma knives. But we do need two surgery departments. We do need two medicine departments. And then we got to say to them, work together and make the best possible program you can. And at the end of the day, we want to be able to say to all New Yorkers, hey, listen, no matter what the problem is, you can come here and you get quality physicians, quality nurses, and we're going to do the best, we're going to do as well as you can get healthcare anywhere in the country. And I think we're getting there. And
I don't think there's any question you're getting there. How does Burke fit into this?
Oh, I think that rehabilitation units like Burke are important too. Now, New York Presbyterian is a 52 institution system, one of the largest in the world. And so we got all kinds of hospitals, rural hospitals, suburban hospitals, hospitals which take care of enormous numbers of indigent, nursing homes. We have to have a full spectrum because people who want New York Presbyterian want it in many different ways, in many different places.
Somebody told me the other day they were moving to Boston into a retirement home run by Mass General.
That's interesting.
I learned something every day if you're not careful. And I thought that was interesting because one of the things my friend Oscar and I tried to talk the hospital into, one of the things we failed, was in the old tower, the Baker Pavilion at New York Hospital,
right,
to put in a assisted living area. Because right across the street is Mary Manning Walsh, which is a Catholic retirement home, mm-hmm, with assisted living. But when I heard about it, this was a fellow called Carl Mueller, who I happen to know, and he said that this whole thing was run, well, it's not a big step from a nursing home, which are generally dreary as hell,
yeah,
into an assisted living place.
I think that having places where people can go which are upbeat, and yet one of the important things is to have good health care as well as other services, is a wonderful function. And over the years, it may well be that hospitals will play a larger role. But I want to just say how much I enjoyed being able to talk to you for a little bit about healthcare and seeing it through your eyes. We really ought to get you to write a kind of a chronicle of the last 50 yeah. years, because you've seen the whole thing.
Well, it's been a rocky road. And the interesting thing is the relations with the medical school. I mean, we're bound together, and we can't separate, and we can't get along. It's like a bad marriage half the time.
Well, every once in a while it's good, and some good stuff happens.
But right now, I think it's good.
Yep.
I think Tony Guida is an outstanding man.
I think we got fortunate that we have a nice family of people on the school board of overseers, the hospital board, some good chiefs. So, listen, the main thing, as I think you said before, is that if we together can help do something worthwhile for all the people who come here, we can feel good when we walk home at night. We've done something useful.
Good.
Nice
well,
to
you're
talk
nice
to, you.
To come.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.